Hello, everybody, and welcome to Outward, Slate's show that brings you all of the canonical gay feelings, pride, shame, maybe that little nagging itch you should probably go see a doctor about. Okay, that's actually a very different episode. I'm Jules Gill-Peterson, and I'm happy to be back on the airwaves after taking a little transgender break, which is how I call plastic surgery. And as you can hear in my voice, baby, I'm more beautiful than ever.
I don't think that was possible, Jules. You were already a 10 plus. I'm Christina Cotarucci, a senior writer at Slate. So happy to be here for Pride Month with y'all.
Yeah, and I'm Brian Lauder, an editor at Slate, and I am delighted to be here all together again. I missed you, Jules. Glad you're back.
Such a good feeling, and just in time because, you know, it's June. And let me just say, listeners, okay, if you're holding your breath just a little this Pride Month, I want to officially give you permission to just exhale with me right now.
This is a mindfulness app now.
Yeah.
Hey, why not? We deserve. We all know tensions have been running pretty high this whole year, but especially now we're gathering to celebrate, reflect, and also maybe renew our commitment to the militant roots of pride, because we need them. Mm-hmm. Staggering anti-gay and anti-trans political attacks are just racking up left and right. Pride celebrations are maybe banned or at least canceled in some parts of the United States. There's just a lot of uncertainty about what's to come and some really important questions, I think, about how to put all of this in some kind of perspective. So for this Pride Month, Christina, Brian, and I thought we would just like dive right into those complicated, messy feelings right there with you. And so first, okay, we have to talk about Target. The big box retailer became one of the month's most talked about case studies in rainbow capitalism after an onslaught of right-wing media singled out Target's Pride collection and merchandise as apparently uniquely immoral, leading not just to a bunch of people going into stores and ransacking displays, threatening employees, but also to Target itself walking back or possibly removing some Pride merchandise or displays from some locations in what critics, you know, sometimes would see as a kind of capitulation. So Christina has a wonderful new piece out embracing the big, huge, ambivalent feelings she got from this whole saga. And we'll try to sort through ours as well with her. Then we'll be joined by journalist Delilah Friedler, who has a moving new essay exploring the existential strain on queer and trans communities in rural Tennessee in the wake of that state's legislative attacks on trans people and the renewed aggression of white supremacists and open Nazis. Delilah actually asks us to set aside our preconceived notions that southern states or rural settings are inherently anti-queer and anti-trans, or even that we should try to let go of those places or magically relocate everyone to a big city in some blue state. So we'll really get into talking with her about the genuine power of despair and maybe an interesting kind of rural southern resilience in this dizzying moment. Clearly, tough feelings deserve their place at Pride. But I promise you, this episode isn't here just to get you down. We'll have our usual prides and provocations to tickle you with, not to mention our monthly updates to the gay agenda. But first, I believe, Brian, you have a special announcement for us.
Yes, I do. I wanted to let our listeners know about a series that we have running in Slate this week, the week that the show comes out, called Not Quite Pride. If you've been listening to the show, you know that for some time now, but especially this year, life for trans and queer people in America has gotten a lot scarier due to the coordinated legislative assault and related vigilante attacks that have been alleged against us. Now, while we're obviously still proud of our communities and culture this June, it would be a lie to say that we're not feeling other emotions as well. Things like despair, fear, and maybe even contempt. So at Slate, we decided to make space for those darker and more complicated emotions and responses to this state of emergency that we're living in the form of a series of essays. So as Jules mentioned on the show today, you're going to hear from one of our authors, Delilah, who's written about the grief many trans and queer people are suffering as they contemplate fleeing beautiful rural areas in states like Tennessee. but that is just one part of Not Quite Pride. We have a shrug of indifference from a queer historian who knows the secret of why we'll win. We have a horny postcard from the writhing masses of Pensacola Beach, and a deep dive into the separatist fantasy of lesbian reproduction without men. All of these different queer reactions to this moment we're living through, all of them not quite pride. We'll link to this package on our show page. I hope you will take the time to read all of the pieces and share them far and wide this pride season.
I love that. What a great idea for a package.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
All right, now it is time for Prides and Provocations. Christina, why don't you start us off?
I'm laughing because Jules just promised that, like, it's not all sad, and here I am to share, like, a really earnest on main moment of provocation for myself. So
make me a liar, Christina. Go ahead, I dare you.
Yeah.
So I came down with COVID actually half an hour before I was supposed to go to my first Pride event this year.
Oh, homophobic.
And I was out for the entirety of Pride, obviously, here in DC. If you listen to the bonus episode I hosted last week, you heard me talk about how excited I was for a bunch of things that I was going to do. I'm actually still kind of shaken up about it. I feel like I'm mourning something. Really, what I wanted to talk about was that missing Pride, it really drove home how much I've come to rely on Pride celebrations to kind of carry me through the year and come back to in my mind as a reminder of the things that make life so great. And part of this is that, you know, I'm 35 and sort of like those messy nights where everybody really commits to wearing their best looks and going out kind of hard just feel fewer and further between for people in my friend group because some of them have kids now. I mean, me and Deb are still like out here being 25, but like it feels like it doesn't come around that often. Along those same lines, it feels like the future is really uncertain right now for a lot of things around queer life. It felt particularly important this year to go and celebrate Pride because it feels like we're at the start of what might be like a long turn toward an uncertain end. I felt the same way a year ago when Roe was overturned. We just don't know how this goes. We can't see around the next curve in the trajectory of our country, our politics, our lives. For me, it's been really destabilizing. Just one of the most stabilizing things in my life is queer community and the strength that I take from that. So it was really sad to miss it. Not sure I'll ever get over it. And, you know, just asking everyone to send me a little happy pride sparkle if you have any to spare this year.
So many.
Oh my God, so many.
Thank you. Yeah. How are you feeling, Jules?
No, I mean, I'm overall feeling terrible, just like you. Also, I'm only a hair under 35. I'm also really feeling that. But I will say, I'm feeling provoked, but in a positive sense. I kind of wanted to have something both lovely and kind of, you know, superficial-ish. I mean, you know, listeners may know the most homophobic thing about me is that I actually don't really like musical theater. I don't actually watch the Tony Awards. However, I was happy to see and sort of pleasantly provoked or thought there was some pride in a provocation from this month's Tony Awards. Two non-binary performers won Tony Awards Sunday evening, Alexis Newell and Jay Harrison Gee. They weren't only, you know, the first non-binary performers to sort of win, as far as I know. They kind of swapped with those two nominations that they won.
Nice.
You know, both turned up looking stunning and brought a kind of, you know, Black non-binary presence to the Tony Awards, but also both had been a prompt for a conversation around the gendered categories in awards ceremonies and in awards more broadly, because they both won gendered category awards, which is just like, you know, on its face, pretty absurd. And, you know, in a way, it was sort of like them accepting the honor was kind of like a compromise they had to make, right? For recognition for their wonderful work, which, you know, because of my homophobia, I haven't seen, but I'm certain is magisterial. And I just, you know, there's just something like, I feel like gender categories in award shows, again, super low down on the priority list, but like kind of one of these things where it's like, yeah, right. Like no one even says the word actress anymore. It's like not really, like we just say actor or performer, and it's like, okay. Also, award shows are too long. So like definitely eliminate the gender categories, slim down those shows for us, and, you know, provide an opportunity, not just for non-binary performers, but actually for everyone to I think, enjoy the difference that not having to gender your excellence or your recognition might make. So thanks to them both for being gracious enough to accept gendered awards, but also kind of give a little provocation to the Tonys and to us all this month. Brian, what about you?
Okay, so I think we often think of PMPs as sort of a binary, you know? Like...
Speak for yourself. What did I just say?
Yeah, no, Jules was definitely both, but okay, point taken.
Maybe some of our listeners think this way. You know, you've got the pride or the provocation. But it's actually, I've learned in sort of thinking about mine for this month, it's a circle. Often a pride could lead into feeling provoked, or a provocation could go into a pride.
Wow, so not even a spectrum, but a full...
I think a circle. So so I'm going to need your help deciding which one this is, because I can't really figure it out, right?
We got you.
Okay, so I have got a super secret scoop for us from none other than the New York Times. This is from a Times employee who asked not to be identified to avoid retaliation from the company.
Oh my God.
But he sent me a photo from the Times employee cafeteria. And this photo was of something called Pride Hummus.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
I'm going to describe the Pride Hummus to you. It is in a milkshake cup, plastic milkshake cup.
Excuse me?
And it was five layers of different colored hummus.
Blew.
Now, what our investigative journalism has not revealed yet is whether this was food coloring or whether it was different vegetable hummuses, which is possible. But we definitely have purple, indigo, green, orange, red, and then the regular, like, beige. like on top. And
because
this,
it's the inclusive pride flag.
Yeah, and this pride hummus. And this was, by the way, $5.99 at the Times employee
cafeteria. Okay, also, I'm just thinking about hummus, you're meant to dip. So you're then supposed to, like, dip all the way to the bottom of this cup.
Of this,
and
like, milkshake
hand
cup.
Just, like, getting hummus on all sides on the way down once you get to the purple.
Multicolored hummus.
Oh, that's the BDSM hummus collection.
Nobody ever say we don't do real investigative reporting on this show.
So, yeah, my whistleblower wrote to me and said that their brain went into white noise mode thinking about how we went from Stonewall to $5.95. This garbage. And they shared that they were against banning Pride products. And this is apropos of our discussion about Target. They were against banning Pride products until they saw the Pride hummus.
Valid.
So I don't know, guys. This Pride hummus initially sort of upset me. I was provoked. But then, and it's made our whistleblower want to, like, rip rainbow tchotchkes off of store shelves, I think. That's kind of frightening. But then I was like, is the cafe chef that did this actually, am I proud of them? Is it like so far that it's camp or something? I don't know.
First of all, you had to make, what, seven different kinds of hummuses?
Yeah, either that's we're food coloring like seven, like five or seven bowls, or we're actually making like a spinach one and like a ube one. I don't know, but so someone's doing that. So I don't know. What do you guys think? Is that a pride or a provocation or something in between?
I am really hung up on the image of a fist plunging deep into a milkshake cup full of hummus. And honestly, that's giving pride.
It's giving pride.
I will say this. I don't want to eat it for whatever that's worth.
All right. I have another provocation this Pride Month. Usually, it is a hallowed pride tradition that we get to mercilessly roast all the terrible pride tributes from our corporate identified community, our friends of corporation experience. The tacky swag, the cringy slogans, the thirsty ad campaigns, the corny, the offensive, the shameless. We love to hate it. This year, that's not really the vibe. This Pride, I don't know if y'all have noticed, things are looking quite different. It seems like way fewer companies are doing the big rainbow social media avatar for all of June thing. There was the thing where Major League Baseball disinvited the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence from a Pride Night and then reinvited them after like a counter backlash. And then there's Target. The Target Pride Collection, which seems to be getting more and more unhinged every year, became the subject of a concerted right-wing intimidation campaign where, as Jules said, that people were filming themselves vandalizing store displays. They were threatening and harassing Target workers. People were calling in bomb threats. There's some kind of boycott Target song rocketing up the right-wing charts.
Oh my God.
And Target responded by, in many stores all over the country, moving the displays to lower traffic areas, taking down signs. And certain items were actually removed from the shelves and from their online marketplace across the board, including a swimsuit designed for trans feminine people and sort of a hilariously benign fanny pack because it was designed by a gay who made other products with like kitschy, tongue-in-cheek satanic imagery. So they're not even selling that anymore. Some Target employees are also saying their stores aren't selling any items referencing trans identity at all. So I found myself feeling pretty irritated and kind of down about this, in spite of the fact that I really don't think there was ever anything useful politically about selling these products. I don't think it matters to our lives or our safety or our happiness. I don't really buy that it helped change the culture toward like LGBT acceptance. I was kind of thinking to myself, like, why does this still feel wrong? Why does this feel like a political threat if it was never a political asset to begin with? You know, what was corporate pride all about? What purpose does it serve? So I spent some time thinking about this. I published a piece on Slate about it titled "The Dirty Secret of Corporate Pride." Thanks to my editor for that one. It makes it sound really spicy. If you want to go read it, you know, it's on the website. We'll link to it on our show page. But I want to ask you guys, how did you absorb that news? What do you think it all means?
At first, I was like, oh, I think I'm just mourning the loss of having been able to absolutely torch the Target Pride like collection every summer and make fun of it because it was just sort of like a background, like, ugh, like, look at this dumb shit that we have to deal with every year. But like many things lately, I just sort of feel more sort of the uptake of what was going down because obviously came on the heels of Dylan Mulvaney receiving like two cans of Bud Light,
right.
Which like, again, this sort of new version of right-wing boycott that's not actually boycotting corporations at all, but is like using the term boycott as a pretense for, at least engaging in representations of violence against especially trans people or LGBT people and kind of just using products as effigies or surrogates is alarming. And, you know, watching,
like yeah, shooting watching, their Bud Light cans
shooting all your Bud Light cans. Yeah. And like when people go into stores and rip down displays and destroy merchandise, I'm not sad for the loss of commodities. I'm concerned for the safety of people who are working other people who are in those spaces. And let's be real, big box stores and malls in America function as privatized public space. And so, you know, there is just sort of this way that I think a lot of how the normalization of a culture of violence operates is by first identifying kind of like non-human targets, right? That you can act out a lot of violence on, not because you really believe you're hurting the people you want to hurt, but because it's a prelude or a pretext to doing that, or it's a way of kind of like showing people that it's okay to do that or inciting them. And that is the thing that really has just left me feeling stressed in a very United States kind of way where I'm like, okay, I'm very worried about like real world violence, right? Yeah. Against especially trans women. But like, why in America do I have to route that fear through watching like a corporate display get ripped down by someone who's doing a front-facing video? Like, that just feels so weird. It's so 2023 that like at that point in my thought process, I'm like, I'm angry. I'm closing my phone and I'm going to go drink coffee and think about something else.
Yeah. I don't know. I found myself reflecting a bit on what Target in particular meant to me as a like not out yet, but definitely semi-aware queer kid in a small town in South Carolina. And I think there's a funny way in which Target kind of represented a liberal safe space to me growing up. And I'm not saying that that makes any sense when you like analyze it, right? Like it is, as you write, like a corporation, it's there to make money. But in my social world, and especially in comparison to like Walmart, Target was the place that you would go where it seemed that their values were like aligned with, I don't know, like human goodwill and happiness and inclusion. And this was before they had pride displays, right? I'm talking about like in the early 2000s.
I mean, their pride displays have become kind of legendary.
Yeah.
Like they sell a ton of products from, and, like now they're actually good about like choosing queer designers and stuff like that. Like it's actually been kind of like a standout among big box retailers in that way.
Exactly. And, you know, and until now, they were often, those displays were at the front of the store, you know, or near it, at least even in South Carolina, right? Like I have gone in and seen that during trips and things. And I'm not like mourning Target, but I do think there's something there about maybe just that store, but possibly other companies feeling like either little safe oases or like allies to some extent, depending on where you live and what your context is. It feels like a regional question to me. And I wonder if our listeners, who don't live on the East Coast or whatever, who live in smaller places, share that sense. It may not be, you know, the radical anti-capitalist sort of politics that I aspire to, but like it is, I think there's like a social thing there that is important.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too, in that back when we had Brandon as one of the hosts, and he's also from South Carolina, he was saying that he went back home during June and the TD Bank in his neighborhood in DC had the rainbow stuff on and the one in South Carolina didn't. And to me, that was, you know, not surprising, but also the ultimate, like, look, they're only doing it where it's profitable for them. But to think that, you know, Target up to now kind of did this everywhere, as far as I know, does make me think that perhaps for people who didn't have a queer community and or were just in hostile places, like this was a spot to be like, oh, yeah, there's like good stuff happening and like good vibes around LGBT stuff. And also, it just made products affordable and accessible to a huge number of people.
Yes.
And like the fact that they were selling, you know, a swimsuit with, they called it like a tuck friendly swimsuit for trans femmes, like that kind of a product has not always been available at like mass market retailers across the country. But so I was thinking also about what was bad about corporate pride. And to me, it was the rainbow washing aspect of it, where like it was so easy for companies to put on a parade float, you know, the money that it cost them to do that and whatever loss of goodwill back then from homophobes was worth the good vibes that they were getting from people, especially in like centers of power like DC or New York, where then those people would go back to their jobs where they're making decisions, especially these like well-meaning cishet allies who would go back and be like, Facebook, wasn't that nice? They like love gay people.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think like a light bulb moment for me reading your piece, Christina, is, and you're like, you talk about the way that there's been a lot of framing. Rainbow capitalism was somehow leading cultural norms, when in reality, it just merely reflects them back. And so the fact that a bunch of random companies got really into this, like maybe Target was a little more on the, you know, trying to monetize a kind of cultural wave through literal merch, right? But a lot of the other corporate pride is actually just an employee side thing. It's a legal liability issue. If you want to hire people who are LGBT, you can't discriminate against them. And also, like, you can't recruit them if your workplace is not seen as welcoming. And, you know, I was thinking about this because I can always bring a little Canadian perspective to the show.
Oh, my God. Yay.
You know, I mean, you know, some of my first prides when I came of age, because I'm so shockingly young, you know, back in the early to mid aughts, you know, Canada had already legalized same-sex marriage in 2005. And I can remember going to pride parades, you know, in the wake of that. And we were all ready. I mean, I have my own TD Bank story in Toronto from like 2006 or seven, where I was like, well, here we go. And one thing that's really interesting is, if that seems kind of relatively early compared to the United States, you know, one of the things I've been keeping an eye on is this summer in Canada, this month, you know, the outbreak of a lot of anti-gay, anti-trans kind of local confrontations around Pride, and Canadians really struggling to make sense of it. And so wanting to say, oh, America's infiltrating us again. We're importing their bullshit. And it's like, oh, so you literally can't imagine that there are homophobes and transphobes in Canada because you've seen this kind of corporate, like, you know, consensus for so long. And I think that is the thing that I hope, you know, we could kind of have like a public reckoning around, maybe less so for LGBT people, maybe more just for the general public. It's like, no, that's maybe not a useful measure of progress. And also, it doesn't provide any insulation, right? It never stacked up or accrued anything to serve as a barrier against this kind of now huge wave of homophobic and transphobic political attacks, right? I just think there's a kind of trickiness here, but maybe an opportunity for a bigger public conversation about what we thought was happening for the past 10 years, what really happened, and maybe what the takeaways from that might be.
Yeah, I do wonder whether this will sort of show people who were maybe uncritically appreciative of corporate pride just how flimsy that so-called support was.
And maybe also how flimsy or not sort of not lasting, like, an idea of like corporate peer pressure, if that's the right term, might have been. Like, I think, I probably have felt this at various moments that like, well, maybe the corporations are disingenuous or just, you know, neutral about this. But having, for example, this ad that's been on Delta flights on the jet bridge forever of these two gay guys absolutely being gay, like you know, cuddling each other on the plane that I notice every time. I've thought that, well, that is like going to like, pressure people who maybe aren't comfortable with me being on this flight visibly gay into at least like shutting up and leaving me alone, right? Or like it's going to set the tone somehow.
I think
I believed that.
I definitely believed that.
What we're seeing now, I think, is that that's just not true, that there were plenty of people who maybe were cowed into a little bit of quiet about it for a time. But now that the tides have turned and that the energy is sort of going the other way, that was not quite so strong of a deterrent, you know, really, that they were just sort of waiting to come out.
I just think there's a new boldness among right wingers when it comes to harassing people in public spaces, because their anger is being inflamed and they're seeing all these videos of people doing that same thing in public space and those people being applauded for it and treated like heroes for it. And so I feel like we're now seeing the same thing around just like trans people being in public and being harassed. There was that story about that gay couple on Amtrak with kids. And now this Target stuff where employees are bearing the brunt of it. Right. And I imagine also queer and trans people shopping in the Pride section. It just feels like there's like a little bit of a social contract that was being thinly held in place in part by those like cute gay ads that now it's like the anger is able to come out at companies too, to be like, well, no, this company is woke. And so like I'm against this entire policy and I'm going to make a thing about it.
Yeah.
In that same vein, you know, in this sort of era where there's a lot more public confrontation and this just sort of unclear, what are we going to do? Who do you appeal for? Do you want someone to intervene? Well, it's not the state. It's certainly not the police. Is it going to be a corporation, right? Would you like them to enforce a certain set of norms when that was never really what they were promising to do, right? And you know, genuinely complex issue. There are lots of different beliefs, you know, amongst queers and trans people about what you should do in those moments. But I think, you know, genuinely speaking, we're just sort of dealing with some difficult aftermath of something that's kind of been brewing for a long time. But it just sucks to see it all burn so intensely and so weirdly and, you know, take away our little cheap rainbow accoutrement.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this. I could obviously talk about this all day.
Yeah.
Listeners, we'd really love to hear what you think about all this. Let us know your feelings on corporate pride and whether they've changed this season. You can reach us at outwardpodcast@slate.com. And, you know, feel free to send us a voice memo if you want. We love to hear your voices.
We really do. We demand your voices. Where are your voices?
Where are the voices?
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So
First, it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
Delilah Friedler has captured a consequence of the ongoing war on trans and queer people in this country that we haven't heard nearly enough about. She writes, quote, "Under such hostile, even genocidal conditions, queer and trans people living rurally, especially in states like Tennessee and Florida, face impossible choices. Do they uproot, leaving behind their quiet lives, gardens, and favorite hiking and foraging spots? Or do they stay in places where some of their families have lived for generations, and others have painstakingly forged queer community where none existed, at possible risk to their health and safety? Either path is fraught with fear, uncertainty, and the grief of losing home." Delilah's time living in Tennessee and her networks there have allowed her to bring us a rich and heartbreaking report about this forced migration crisis as it's unfolding. It's a story that grapples with all of those emotions that she mentions, and one that I think invites us to see possibilities for trans and queer life that we maybe hadn't considered before, even as those possibilities are being narrowed. Delilah is a wonderful journalist and Slate contributor who's written on queer community and climate justice for Rolling Stone, Mother Jones, Pitchfork, Vice, and more. We spoke recently about her great Rolling Stone article about the queer underground nightlife scene and ketamine during our chat with Alex Belser on the episode about queering psychedelics. I'm so proud to have this new piece in Slate, and I'm thrilled that Delilah is here today to talk with us about it. Welcome to Outward, Delilah.
Thank you.
I thought that maybe we could start with you just telling us a little about your history with Tennessee. You know, how did you end up living there for a while, and what did you make of that experience?
I got connected to queer community in Tennessee when I was already living in the South. I'm from California, but I have a lot of family in New Orleans. And after I graduated college, I went to live in New Orleans, and through that met some people who knew other people with this community land project in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And so I was invited up there. I think it was the third time that I visited that I was going through a bit of a personal crisis and didn't really know what was my place in the world. And so some people that were living out in the country on this land in Tennessee encouraged me to come and live with them while I sort of figured things out. And so I think I was 24 when I decided to like make the jump into this totally unfamiliar living situation. I had never lived in the countryside. I had never lived in the South outside of like the liberal bubble of New Orleans. And I moved up there and I stayed for 9 months.
Mm-hmm. And so tell us a little bit about the genesis of this piece. You know, you've obviously got a network of friends and contacts still in Tennessee. What was happening and what did you sort of want to capture in this story?
Yeah, I mean, from the very beginning of this year, it was really obvious that my friends in Tennessee were super scared, overwhelmed, and busy as a result of all the legislation. And, you know, most of these friends live an hour and a half or more from Nashville, where the state capital is. But they were going there multiple times a week to meet with legislators, to testify in hearings, just speak about, you know, the trans bathroom bills, the sports bills, the hormone bills, the anti-drag bill. You know, they were calling it in Tennessee the slate of hate because there was just such a comprehensive effort. And so this was going on in many states, in different parts of the South, in different parts of the country. But I became very aware of what was happening in Tennessee specifically because my friends were just so like teetering on the edge of burnout from everything they were doing to try to organize in the interests of our rights.
I mean, I love the fact that, you know, this community that, you know, might be small town or rural based is nevertheless, you know, making these long trips to Nashville. And how you tell the story of these folks is really helpful for city brats like me, you know, reminding us not just that like tons of queer and trans people in the South and they're there for all sorts of reasons, but also that like people who have a kind of intentional small town or rural life in Southern states as queer and trans people aren't necessarily doing it like, you know, as like escapism from the rest of the world, but are very embedded in both their local communities and state level issues and state politics. And how would you describe that?
A lot of trans people are really involved in the local community. And the first thing that comes to mind because of the topic we're discussing is activism and organizing. And, you know, even if we just think of quote unquote left-wing organizing, if you're working with people from, let's say, the whole county, that's a rural county in Tennessee, that's not the same as like organizing with social justice people in a city where they are probably queer themselves or they have trans friends. Like if you're part of some kind of like healthcare coalition or like, you know, like a prison abolition working group in rural Tennessee, like you could be the only queer person in the room, let alone trans person. And so a lot of my friends are really involved in those kind of efforts where even if it isn't bringing them into contact with, you know, the full religious and or conservative flank of their region, it's still going to be a little bit of extra work for them, I guess, to try to like integrate into these spaces and maybe do more education. And then, of course, that's to say nothing of like if you go to the town council meetings or you go to like the county board of supervisors or whatever it may be and you show up and testify. And it's just a lot more common than if you were doing that kind of work. In a city like New York, it's a lot more common to just be the only trans person in the room or maybe that these people have ever seen in their life. So I think it shows how committed people are to their activism, that they're willing to like take that step. And I think a lot of times it just becomes like a fact of life.
You profile a few different people in this story. I wonder if you could pick one of them, maybe Bree or Jack, and show us how that shift from a period where there was like some kind of harmony or some way of sort of making a life to the environment now, which is being shaped by all of this legislation and attacks, and how that's looked for, you know, one of those individuals.
So one of the people that I profiled is this person, Bree. They work as a substitute teacher and they teach at different schools in their county. So something that they told me was that there is only one school that is so sort of like remote and sheltered that they don't feel comfortable showing up and sort of announcing their queerness and their transness there. And the rest of the schools that they teach at, you know, they're wearing rainbows and a pronoun pin and all these things. But they told me that that situation was the same before and after the slate of hate came to Tennessee in the legislature. So in other words, like the way that they feel comfortable showing up in schools, the way that they feel received by students and other staff members didn't necessarily change. What did change was the measures that Bree had to take to protect themselves. Actually, like, digitally is one of the main things that they mentioned, because they had been present at, you know, this standoff involving a lot of people from far right groups outside of a drag brunch in Cookeville, Tennessee. And, you know, I don't know that they were specifically targeted after that, but they became aware that people from some of these far right groups were targeting queer and trans activists in Tennessee and, you know, posting their public information online, what we call doxing, was kind of just the beginning of it, because people were being hacked and having like their entire accounts taken over and information stolen. And another big concern is like infiltrators. There was just recently a story that came out from Tennessee about a organizing meeting that was infiltrated by someone from the far right, who basically took all of their plans for protesting immigration policies and leaked them to the press.
Wow.
And so I think what I'm trying to say is, like, we might assume that the result of the changing climate is that trans people feel less safe walking down the street in their small town or going to buy groceries. And I'm not going to say that that isn't true, but the stories that I've actually heard are a lot more about being sort of targeted through these kind of like shadowy underground networks and like digital hacking. And a lot of times the people who are doing that are not actually from these rural places. They could be from other states entirely. Exactly. So, you know, you start to see that the threat and also the prejudice is not necessarily coming from your neighbors in this small town. It's coming from higher up in the Republican Party. It's coming from shadowy evangelical political networks. And it's coming from a lot of far right dudes who are really sitting behind their computers and trying to do as much damage as they can without even really knowing who you are or where you live or things like that.
Yeah. You know, one thing that you write about is that even as a lot of these folks are trying to think about how to do coalition building with their neighbors, I think you write really beautifully about this idea of rural life and the connection to nature that it allows people to have. You have this line from the piece where you say, "I feel especially bereaved by the growing sense that conservatives and the white folks protected by their regimes are developing a monopoly on access to nature. In cities, we can love openly and revel in community, but rarely do we get to know the peace of the forest, recalibrate our bodies by laying on the bare earth, splash with friends in a secret swimming hole, or taste the juices of a freshly plucked pawpaw." I would love to hear you to speak a little bit about that aspect of this, because, you know, who gets to have access to nature is such an interesting question.
Yeah, I think anyone who has ever lived in, I'm going to say, cosmopolitan area instead of instead of liberal bubble, because living, you know, it's not just like a bunch of liberal people in a circle trying to keep everything out. It's rather just a city where diversity is recognized and honored and people learn to get along with their neighbors. So if you've ever lived in a place like that, you've probably had the experience of going on a camping trip or a road trip where you pull into the gas station and suddenly it's like every car has a MAGA bumper sticker and people are saying things you wouldn't normally hear in your city home. And it's just like, as soon as you get like a certain radius outside of cities in most states, I would say, even if it's California, you encounter an increasing number of conservative people. This phenomenon is not new. I think it goes back a very long time. But when you look at posts online of trans people who are saying, "Hey, is it safe to keep living where I'm living? And I want to leave rural Tennessee, or I want to leave Florida. Where is safe to go?" And everyone's saying, "Well, you should move to New York, or you should move to Miami," or well, that's still in Florida. But, you know, I was trying to give another metropolitan area because there are many. But, you know, essentially, like, what is already underway is an exodus out of red states and out of rural regions to allegedly comfortable, safe blue cities or blue states. It's hard to not see that the overall trend is that queer and trans people are having to leave behind places that are more remote and thus have a view of the night sky and places to go paddle on a river. And I don't think that that's anyone on the right's goal is, hey, let's exclude all these people from nature. I don't think anyone is thinking
of, but it's an effect.
It's an effect, but it's an effect that I want people to think about more because it is devastating and, you know, really sad to think that. Yeah. Because the thing I think I'm thinking about a lot right now is, like, I hope to God I'm wrong, but it really seems like the political moment we're living in with regard to transphobia is potentially just the beginning of something that could get a lot worse. And so if it already feels a little uncomfortable to go park your car next to the MAGA car with the gun in the front and go paddling with your friends, then I just wonder, what could it be like down the road when more of these laws have been passed and more rhetoric has been used to whip people up? And suddenly it's like, not only do you not want to live in these places as a trans person, but maybe you don't even want to go there to enjoy the nature. And I'm sure there's already people who would feel too uncomfortable venturing into certain towns to get access to a forest or a river or whatever. And I just really hope that that doesn't get much worse, because that access to the natural world is so necessary and vital and healing for everyone.
That is all the time we have for this segment. There's so much more in this piece that we could talk about, but you can go read it. Our guest has been Delilah Friedler. Her piece is titled, "Trans People Have Led Rich and Surprising Lives in Rural America. Now They Face an Impossible Choice." And it's now out as part of Slate's Not Quite Pride series. Please be sure to read it and all the others. Share them with your friends. And Delilah, thank you so much for writing this piece and for being here with us on Outward today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really great to have more opportunities to discuss what's going on in the South and in rural places, because it doesn't get enough attention.
Yeah, oh, man. I agree.
Well, that's about it for this month, but before we go, we've got your monthly updates to the lovely gay agenda. Brian, you want to kick us off?
Sure. I, being a very nerdy person, have a documentary that is on PBS this month. Is called Casa Susana, and it is part of the American Experience series that PBS does. Just so you know how to get it, it premieres on June 27th, but I think it's already streaming if you have the PBS Passport app, which is a wonderful app that you should get if you don't have it. But Casa Susana is just this really lovely, sort of straightforward, quiet kind of documentary that tells the story of a underground network of transgender women and cross-dressing people who found a kind of refuge at this house up in the Catskills in New York. It provided like a safe place for them to dress the way that they wanted to socialize, to have these lovely seeming dinner parties and cocktail parties. And again, this is all in the 50s and 60s. So, you know, a time when that was pretty dangerous elsewhere. The film sort of uses the memories of four different people, two of whom were there and so are quite old at this point, and then the children of two people who were heavily involved. And so you get a portrait of what this sort of haven was like during the period that it was in operation. You know, it has a pretty light touch to showing a lot of different complicated things about what is, you know, quote unquote, cross-dressing. What does it mean to be trans and cross-dress? How did those categories sort of shift during this moment? Also about being stealth or not, sort of internalized transphobia. And you even get these fascinating details about like wives who would take their husbands, you know, there and be there with them while they were participating in the social scene. So just a really nice snapshot of a place, lovely doc. It's called Casa Susana and it's on PBS.
Well, I never do this, but if you're feeling hungry for more, after that doc airs on the 27th, American Experience has got a second episode for you on Christine Ooh. Jorgensen, world famous trans woman of the 1950s. And I'll just say one of the talking heads in that episode is yours truly. So if you're not tired of my voice,
wow.
and you want to see me, I'll be there to talk more trans with you.
I can't believe we have a movie star on this
podcast. PBS, Ryan. Christina, PBS. We love. I mean, it's my dream come true.
That sounds really great, Brian.
Yeah. Well, Jules, do you want to go ahead and share yours since you...
I mean, funny enough, I also have a documentary recommendation. Yeah. I guess we're just feeling it this month.
Educate yourself this Pride Month.
Right. Well, I've got one that's just delightful and darling and wonderful. There's this new documentary film, that just premiered this very month at Tribeca. It's called Chasing Amy.
Ooh, I've heard of this.
No, I didn't accidentally glitch there. It really is called Chasing Amy. This is a wonderful new documentary film by director Sav Rogers, who also is sort of the protagonist of it. And it's a really wonderful film about his sort of experience, in the 1990s, watching this, now kind of infamous 1997 film, Chasing Amy, and seeing, at the time, he felt to be really positive LGBT representation, and as an adult, kind of going after and reconstructing what that all meant when other parts of the film, definitely don't age well, like a guy is falling in love with a lesbian. It's just this wonderful film that I think is just come out to sort of rave reviews. I adore Sav. And really, really recommend it. It just premiered at Tribeca. There are some select screenings going on in June and July, but I expect the way things are going, it's going to expand. So if we make some noise, try and get them to come out to your town, or if you live in one of those bigger cities, definitely go check out this film. I just feel like it's one of those beautiful meditations on how we get super attached to something from a pivotal moment in our lives. And then if you're brave enough to go back to it, it's just always such a wild journey and story. So I highly recommend Chasing Amy.
That sounds great.
That sounds super fun. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I've heard some buzz about it too.
Well, Christina, what do you have?
I am recommending a book because I am learned as well. Not just our docu-fiends here. The book I'm recommending is a novel called Dykette by Jenny Fran Davis. It's about three queer couples on a holiday getaway at one of the couple's second homes in Hudson, New York. It's told through the perspective of a high femme named Sasha, who has a butch boyfriend, and she's grappling with her jealousy of this other femme on the trip who she perceives as sort of a threat to her. She's also sort of fumbling over her desire for commitment and security and domesticity, which she seeks out through what Jenny Fran Davis calls high femme camp antics, which was the title of this essay she wrote. But basically, it's referring to performing over the topness, neediness, demanding what you want in a way that kind of ensures that you'll never be satisfied when you receive it. It's a very, very rich and discomforting novel. I found it to be a really fresh feeling exploration of femme as an identity, something that made me think about a lot of stuff that I had never really thought of before about, what femininity means and how and why we perform it and what that means as a queer person specifically. And this particular person's enactment of femme identity is so specific that it left a lot of room for drama on this trip and some very provocative performance art that I won't spoil.
Oh my God.
Highly recommend it to, I think listeners of our podcast would really enjoy it. Again, it's called Dykette by Jenny Fran Davis.
Oh, that sounds cool. Amazing.
Yeah, I love that.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode. But if your appetite is as expansive as the spectrum of queer sexualities, do I have good news for you? This month, Outward is bringing you weekly bonus episodes to keep your Pride feed well-stocked and maybe well-lubricated. You'll be able to catch my conversation with journalist Evan Urquhart about how different kinds of trans people are processing and also politicizing their grief right now. It's a really beautiful chat, and you can find that alongside other extra episodes from Brian and Christina in your Outward feed. But also, please send us feedback and topic ideas to outwardpodcast@slate.com or send them to us via Facebook or Twitter, where we are at Slate Outward. And as always, a little reminder that if you join Slate Plus, you'll get ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like The Waves and Working, And you'll never hit a paywall on the Slate site. If you want to learn more, you can go to slate.com/outwardplus. June Thomas is our producer and the grand marshal of this bloody parade. Emily Cherish provided some essential and much appreciated editing help this month. If you like Outward, please subscribe in your podcast app, tell your friends about it, and rate and review the show so others can find it. Bye, Christina. Bye, Colin.
Bye, Jules.
Happy Pride.
Stay gay. Yeah, happy Pride.
Happy Pride, everyone.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights. Gay rights now! Gay rights! With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.